mechanics have been pretty good and pretty consistent throughout the years. It's more how he can, you know, we know that he throws hard. He throws, you know, he punches people out. How can he get much quicker at bats and be more efficient so he can stay in games longer? So we have a couple of things that we're going to show him, and that's something that we've done here really good for years, make adjustments and make good pitchers even better pitchers.
That was Joe Espada, Astros manager, after, that was a couple days ago. That was after the Astros, that was on Tuesday, after the Astros acquired Yusei Kikuchi from the Blue Jays. The Astros introduced Kikuchi yesterday. He will start Friday's game, tomorrow's game, against Tampa Bay. And Seth, I'm wondering, there was, to say the trade wasn't popular on Monday night would be the understatement of the year. I'm wondering if you or have other people softened on that now in the 48 hours since.
Sean Pendergast put up a Pender poll where I believe it had like a 97% disapproval rating, which is hard. When you factor in the 10% like contrarian element, where most there's usually 10% of people on any poll are just going to go against the grain just for the hell of it. That's damn near unanimous disapproval. I've softened on it for a couple reasons. One is that I'm an Astros fan and I need them to, I need this to work out for them. So I want Kikuchi, when he shows up in the ballpark for the first time, to have a good first experience. But two, Sean, after the show yesterday, said, he texted me, he said, "Hey, by the way, just so you know, it seems like Spillane might be a little bit more on the positive side of the Kikuchi trade." And I said, "Yes, I do know, and I'm actually looking forward to it, because I need baseball Spo to talk me through this thing." I can see that part where, look, Kikuchi is a hard throwing dude who strikes people out a lot, but and yet the results have been, over the course of his career, he's got a 4.7 ERA. He's above his career ERA right now. Even if it regresses to the mean, he's only got to fall like 0.05 points on the ERA scale. This is where I'm hung up on it, Adam. Do I trust the Astros pitching car wash the same way I would have back in the day when they transformed Gerrit Cole into the guy that he was, or Charlie Morton, or whomever else? Because I don't have that same faith that they can transform even a Framber Valdez, for instance, the way they could a few years ago. And so I don't, like, when I hear Dana Brown talk about pitch selection and things like that, I haven't seen as much pudding in that regard. I need the proof in the pudding.
Well, it is a team, though, that has turned Ronel Blanco into a legitimate major league starter. It is a team that found something with Taylor Scott, who's come out of nowhere to become a very good major league reliever this season. So they have a reputation of being able to turn around pitchers. Remember when they traded for Will Smith a couple of years ago? He even said, like, "Hey, this is the place to go. I'm not having a good year. If I'm going to go anywhere, it might as well be here to try and turn things around." But for me, I was for the trade. Listen, the ERA for Kikuchi isn't very good, but some of the outlying numbers would show that there's been some bad luck in there. The strikeout rate, again, is really high, and if you want a guy with a high strikeout rate, because at least he's not allowing you to put the ball in play. But for me, the big reason was why I was for the trade was just because you're trying to win a World Series now. You can't get to the World Series if you're not in the playoffs, and the best way to make the playoffs is to improve your starting pitching. And Kikuchi gives you a better chance of winning that game on Friday than Jake Bloss would have. Now, was the price high? Yeah, it was to a certain degree, but I don't think the three guys that they gave up, I don't think they're like guys that you might not miss all that much, just because Bloss is the best of the three. And that's the guy I wouldn't want to have had to give up, but I'm not all that high on Lo Perfetto. I'm just not. He's 25. In his fourth year of pro ball, who played in the ACC, and he had like a 560 OPS his last 27 games as an Astro, and he strikes out a ton. So, you know, I'm just not all that high on him. And Will Wagner's 26, and he's a corner infielder who doesn't hit for power. Like, to me, that's not a prospect in my book. So, like, if I'm trying to win right now, the guy that I got gives me a better chance right now in 2024 than the three guys that I gave up.
There was a tweet yesterday, or a post on X, that I felt seen a little bit It was from Stewman2285 on X. It was a picture of Jake Mariznick. And it says, many of you Loperfido stands are suffering from what is known as acute Mariznick syndrome. Fall in love with a guy you can't hit, made a few nice catches, and looked cute in his uniform. Unfortunately, there is no known cure. I think there might be an element of truth there. You get excited about the plays that Loperfido makes in the outfield, and yet he provides nothing for you at the plate. Now, unlike Mariznick, I mean, Mariznick, it was known what Mariznick was by the time he was finished with his tenure with the Astros. You knew he wasn't going to be anything at the plate. I guess you could still see the upside with Loperfido. So you saw the good things, and then, you know, let's see what he can do at the plate over time.
With the Astros, the thing with Loperfido is that he was almost like sold by the Astros as the next big thing. Uh-huh. And they brought him up in April, and they made a very big deal about it when they brought him up. And part of that was that the team was struggling at the time. And so you almost wanted to just change the subject. And so they brought him up. He had this, you know, he had some hype around him during spring training, and he had a pretty decent spring. And then he hit like 6 home runs in a week in Albuquerque, which is an absolute launch pad and really should not matter. And so I think people really started to fall in love with him there. And then he made a good first impression. And that first impression matters, I think, more than anything else. He could have started 0-for-20 in his major league career, people would feel a whole lot differently about him now than they do. But he started off strong, and then he faded a little bit. And like to me, I don't see it with, you know, the way that a lot of people do, I guess.
You know what you're saying? You know what you're saying, Adam? Yeah, that I think you might have been a little young to have remembered this. We're not that far apart in age, but I think this is like maybe when I was like 14 or 15 years old. There was a thing called Olean. Have you ever heard of Olean?
I have not.
Okay, so Olean, just as you're saying the Astros sold us on Loperfido, Olean was this artificial fat that they started using to cook chips in, and it was going to be this revolutionary new thing that was going to cure the burgeoning obesity epidemic back in the day, 20 or 30 years ago. And it was like almost too good to be true. Like, tastes just like normal chips. What could be the downside? Leaky bowels. That's all. You might have to wear adult diapers. And it was true. I tried some Olean chips, and then you had later on that day, you'd have like a curious lubrication to your underpants that it was not pleasant. So Loperfido was the Olean that the Astros tried to sell us, and now they're coming out and telling us, by the way, he gives you leaky bowels.
Were these like snack wells where snack wells were like fat free, but they had like 800 calories in every cookie?
Yeah, like more sugar than you could even imagine fitting into that. It'll give you'll your cholesterol will be fine, but you'll have diabetes by 4 p.m. Yeah.
So that's Jake Loperfido for you, is that he's the Olean, of baseball players.
It's still, and that was the other part of it too, was I started reading, you know, you try to go out, and whenever I feel really strong emotionally about something, I try to go out and find smart people who disagree with me. I'll tell you two things. One on the side that convinced me, and the other that I'm not so convinced about. One was, okay, we're a little too close to the situation, perhaps, with Blossom Loperfido, because we've seen the potential upside. We've watched them in the minors, and we've seen some, you know, really good stretches out of them in the minors. Do we have a higher rating on them than the rest of baseball does? And I can totally see that part of it. So, all right, like, dial back my love and affection, like in a Jake Mariznick style. The part I can't get over, though, is I 100% appreciate the analytical side of it. But I don't like it when I'm reading articles that say he's actually a really good pitcher. Disregard the 4.7 ERA because he's got this great stuff and because he strikes a lot of guys out. So he's a good pitcher. Well, no. I feel like that's the potential to be a really good pitcher. But at the end of the day, like, ERA still matters. It's not like batting average is the results over the course of time, over the course of an entire career where you got a 4.7 ERA, that tells me he's just not there yet. So it's still going out on a whim a little bit and thinking that the Astros pitching coaching is just that much better and their analytics are that much better than the Blue Jays or whomever else, that, yeah, you're going to get the best version of Kikuchi. I just can't 100% buy into it yet.
No, I fully understand that. And what you said about the players, a 3-for-1 trade where you basically know of all the players. It's very, very rare. Like normally when you see a 3-for-1, the three guys are in A ball. And so the fact that they traded two guys off their big league roster and then a guy in AAA who people have heard of because his dad played for the team and is probably going to be a Hall of Famer here in a year, like I think that's where people kind of get clouded just a little bit. But I don't think that there is. I think Bloss is the guy that people really like. I don't know about the others. What you said, though, about Kikuchi, like you're not wrong. Like he has not been productive this season. The ERA is well over four. It's approaching five.
That's his career ERA too.
He's been worse than that here in the last couple of months. But I'm gonna get nerdy on you and
do it. Nerd me up. I need it.
So there's a metric called FIP. Fielding independent pitching, and it's basically it basically takes luck out of it. So it basically says so strikeout pitchers.
We talk about FIP on the show.
Okay, good.
I know FIP. Adam, I'm not a moron. I know FIP. Okay.
But his is a run lower. So the fact like Ryan Pressly, when Ryan Pressly was really bad at the start of the year, his FIP was like 2.5 runs lower than the ERA, and the average on balls in play was like the highest in the league for guys who had thrown like 20 innings. And so there was going to be some positive regression there. Now, Ronel Blanco has been the opposite, where Ronel Blanco's FIP is about 2 runs higher than his ERA, and his average on balls in play was below 200. So there's going to be some negative regression, and we've seen that here the last couple of starts. So with Kikuchi, there should be some positive regression. And we'll just have to see if that comes to fruition. If it does, then listen, the Astros possibly got a really good starter who was an all-star just a few years ago.
That was one of the little analytical tidbits that angered me, though, as I was first digesting the trade, was not what you just said, because, like, okay, his FIP on the season being lower than 4.0, that matters, that means something. It was when in Chandler Rome's article, he's talking about this most recent really bad stretch that Kikuchi's had over his last 5 starts or what have you, and he said, well, as bad as it's been, he's had an 8-plus ERA over that stretch. But his FIP is a 4.66, so there's been some bad luck. I'm like, yeah, it's still bad. Like, you can't, don't tell me the FIP is 4.66. That's still, his simulated ERA is 4.66. That's the part that bothers me. They gloss over the, hey, I'm going to throw some advanced stats at you. Just accept them and go with them. I know a little bit of math, Chandler.
It's definitely, the numbers definitely aren't good. He's going to start on Friday, and it's going to be a big start. Like, let's be honest. Like, for the people who are already out on this trade, if he doesn't go 6 and give up, you know, fewer than 2 runs, then people are just going to continue to kill the trade even more. But listen, if he goes out there and pitches great, then that gives everybody, I think, a pretty big reprieve.
You know what? Kikuchi kind of won me over a little bit just by saying that the Astros actually have a lot of fans in Japan. That even though we haven't had a lot of Japanese baseball players in Houston, that the Astros have a lot of fans in Japan. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I like that he said it. It somehow made me feel like, yeah, you know what? We've been way more heavily Cuban than Japanese, and I want to enter a new era where all of a sudden, despite what might have happened with Yuli back in the day and a Dodgers pitcher, that the people of Japan still embrace the Astros somewhat. So this is we can kind of move into that hemisphere.
I vaguely remember the Yuli thing with Darvish in the World Series. That I think the Japanese writers thought that it was funny. So I think that people were cool with that.
It was that whole thing. I mean, that was fueled by a whole lot of, I think it was something people could leap on. And that I think sometimes too, you travel around the world a lot. Like, you know, where are you going? You're going to Bulgaria next week?
And Romania, Sunday.
Bulgaria and Romania. Yeah, you know that, like, we have, I think, heightened sensitivities in a good way, you know, because, you know, we've got a history in this country of some pretty, you know, like, but a heightened sensitivity to that kind of stuff. Whereas, like, when you got guys from Cuba and people from Japan and everything, like, it's not necessarily perceived the same way around, and they joke, I think, a little bit more loosely about some of that stuff, whether it's better or whether it's worse, but
People are less sensitive, I think, around the world than maybe some of us are around here.
Yeah.
But Kikuchi will make his Astros debut Friday against the Rays. It's a team that he knows very well. I did talk to Alex Bregman yesterday just about what it was like facing Kikuchi. And the thing that he said to me, stuff is great, and every single at bat that he has against him is a grind. And Bregman has only faced 10 pitchers more than Kikuchi. Kikuchi, and he's had success against Kikuchi, but he has faced him an awful lot over the course of his career just because Kikuchi spent all that time in Seattle.
Plus, maybe Bregman, you know, one of the best things the pitching coaching staff has done this year was when pitching coach Alex Bregman told Hunter Brown to start throwing his sinker. And then, boom, there you go. So maybe by Bregman, when he gets into the Bregman pitching sphere, Bregman will get Kikuchi right. Everything will be fine.
And Bregman talked to George Springer about Kikuchi. So, you know, you start to get a little bit of familiarity with the teammate. After a while, Astros beat the Pirates last night 5-4, ended a 3-game losing skid, and we saw last night, and we've been seeing this for a while, but there are clear differences between Joe Espada and Dusty Baker, and for me the biggest one is Espada's willingness to go to his bench early in games, and we've seen that really pay off, and it won them the game last night. The ability to go to the bench and use Mauricio Dubon as a pinch hitter in the sixth inning of that game won them the game. You know, Dubon hits the pinch hit two-run homer. And it's been really interesting watching Espada do this and use his bench the way that he has because there's just an aggressiveness. And for me, it's a lot of fun. Like, it's a fun little chess match that you get to see. And so last night, the situation is the Pirates have a left-handed reliever on the mound, Jalen Beeks, and here's Singleton, the left-handed hitter, comes up, and the Astros aren't really going to let Singleton face left-handed pitching, or at least left-handed relievers. So as soon as a team goes to the bullpen, Espada's ready to use the bench. Like, those guys are ready to go, and the Pirates went to the righty instead. They take out Beeks, they go with Colin Holderman, and the Astros were expecting that. Like, Joe Espada said that, like, I'm expecting that matchup, so you almost... you're planning out the matchup that you want. Would you rather have Singleton against Beeks, or would you rather have Dubon against Holderman? He wanted Dubon against Holderman, and it worked out. And so it's been fun to watch just that chess match that you get to see. And I think that overall, I don't know how you felt about it, but I think that it's been a good Espada year.
I think it really has. I think he was hampered a lot by Jose Abreu and some of the really curious decisions that he had to make when it came to small ball early in the season, were that you've got this clunker of a first baseman out there, and that keeps guys off the roster that could have been speedier or that you could have used there. I mean, that was just one element to it. I think they've got to be setting a team record for, like, bunts in the past decade, at least, right? They've had just way more instances of just getting fast guys on the bases and playing small ball in late innings. I do feel that there's an element of him growing and coming into his own as a manager and having, like, the full authority of everything, that we're starting to see a lot more of the good than the bad that perhaps we might have early on.
And he said last night, like, his plan going into the year wasn't to use the bench the way that he has. Like, you know, you have your set starting lineup, or at least a starting lineup that you think you're going to use when spring training comes around, but then guys start to underperform, guys start to get hurt, and you have to adjust on the fly. And I think that he's done a pretty good job of adjusting to what he has on the roster. And he knows that, listen, at first base, we're going to go with Singleton, you know, mostly on an everyday basis, but we have to be ready because we don't really want him to face left-handed relievers. Or right now, the corner outfield position for them is a bit of a mess, with right field being, you know, just kind of a revolving door without Kyle Tucker. So we have to be ready to use everybody. I don't think they wanted to use Victor Caratini as a DH on days when Yiner Diaz starts, but they need another bat in there, so they're going to be aggressive with that. So I think that it's been a good job of Espada adjusting to what to the roster that he has. And, like, that's half the job right there. The job... he's had to learn on the fly a little bit. This season hasn't gone the way that they had planned on it going, but I do think that he deserves credit for figuring things out, and he's put them in a pretty good position.
Yeah, and I think, that's the other thing too about the Caleb Ferguson trade, which is, you know, obviously less heralded and everything, but Caleb Ferguson's had his own issues that you hope the Astros can rectify. But at the very least, he's a lefty. You know, Brian King was the only non-Josh Hader lefty that you would use before the ninth inning beforehand. So now you've got that option too. So for some of the late game stuff, there's more tools and weapons available to Espada right now than there had been earlier on. Helps it. Also makes it easier to make late game decisions when Yiner Diaz is hitting a double or a triple every single night.
Yeah, that's always beneficial. And the fact that they're trying to find offense from somewhere. And the fact that the offense has survived without Kyle Tucker the way that it has been really surprising. Like, when Kyle Tucker went down, we're coming up on 2 months now. It'll be 2 months here on Saturday. It'll be the two-month anniversary of this injury. The fact that they have played as well as they have without Tucker, when you consider what they've had to do in right field without him, it's pretty astounding.
I guess we haven't talked about that yet. Kyle Tucker has moved to the 60 AIL, which is a good thing, and he's probably going to start a rehab assignment pretty soon. So feels like just a week ago we were wondering if Kyle Tucker would even be back before September. That's looking a lot more optimistic.
I don't think he's doing anything. I don't think anything's really changed with him.
Oh, okay.
They put him on the 60-day IL because they needed to bring Leon up.
Right. Yeah, I shouldn't have even mentioned that as like anything relevant or anything. Somebody asked me earlier if it was bad that they put him on the 60 IL. I was like, no, it doesn't matter at all, actually, because he's been injured for 60 days already. Or almost 60 days. So, like, you can do that. Like, you don't have to worry about extending him out any further or anything. Yeah. But that is, like, that's a ray of sunshine that I kind of braced myself for him maybe not even being back until September, until these last few days when he started showing more progress and he's going to go do a rehab assignment soon.
Yeah, I don't know when the rehab assignment is going to be. They don't provide a whole lot of information about it. Basically, the answer that you get is he's progressing. Every time I don't even bother asking anymore because the answer is just going to be he's progressing.
I want to say it was McTaggart. I think I was reading McTaggart this morning that seemed to have the most optimistic take on it than I had read that pleased me. I feel like Tags is almost a little bit pessimistic by nature. So I felt like if he was expressing any kind of optimism, that might be a good thing.
It's very possible I missed it because it's been a busy last couple of days, but they need him back. Like, I don't think there's any doubt that they need him back. And the fact that they've gotten guys to step up, like, they're averaging more than 5 runs a game since he got hurt. And I'm telling you, when he went down, I did not think that this offense was capable of doing that. They're averaging 5 runs a game, and it's not like Yordan Alvarez has hit 20 homers in this stretch. I think Yordan Alvarez went through July, and he hit 4 home runs. So the fact that they didn't get a ton of, like, run production out of Alvarez, and they still stayed afloat, and they still were a decent offense, not a great offense by any stretch, but they were still decent, is surprising to me. But they need him. They need Tucker to come back. They need Alvarez to produce a little bit more power. And the same thing with Altuve and Bregman. Like, those three guys are so key to the rest of this season, just because once you get down to like 5 through 9, the offense just isn't very good. They have to try and scrape together runs. And they were really bailed out yesterday by O'Neill Cruz. And O'Neill Cruz was just awful in that game. Yeah. Both at just the plate and in the field.
He lost the game for him. He just fourth inning.
Three errors in 3 innings. It led to 3 unearned runs, and that's what got the Astros back into that game. They're down 4-0. They're looking dead in that game, and he just handed it to them.
You know, the whole part about that, too, is, man, Pena and how fast he is on the base paths. Like, they were able to capitalize on a lot of that just because Pena is it's just so much fun to watch him run. I love that kid. He's everything. He's like the classic, like, okay, play the game that way, kid. You got a son? Yeah, go play the game. Play the game like Jeremy Pena.
Speed is an incredibly underrated aspect in baseball, and I'm surprised that we don't see more of it. All right, let's switch back to the Texans, just because I've wanted to. We have spent so much time talking about the Texans offense over training camp. I don't know what it's been like for y'all, but I know when I've been in with Lopez, we have spent way too much time talking about the offense. So I do want to go to the defense, because there are 3 big storylines that I want to talk about. The first is Jalen Petrie, and we talked about him a little bit earlier. But when we talk about guys who have big years coming up, I think Petrie is probably at the top of that list. 2 years ago, after he was a rookie, you thought, okay, this could be a cornerstone of your defense for a long time. And then he takes a step back last year in year one under D'Amico's system. What have you seen from him in now his second training camp?
I think that, you know, they've thrown him out there right into the mix and had him being the slot corner with the first team a lot. They've had him playing safety. And I think that you can see there's something there. And, like, he's the same guy he's always been. He's able to just play all over the field. He's very athletic by safety standards, and I think he's very versatile. I get nervous when I look at him lined up playing man versus a slot receiver. Because Petrie does not move like a cornerback, because he's not a cornerback. He's athletic by safety standards, but he's not a cornerback. So I don't think that it's like a bona fide, oh yeah, he's your starting nickel back and he's going to be out there all the time. I think they're going to use him creatively. I think there's going to be times when he is in that role, but I think there's other times where they're going to have Dez King handle the actual. Like, if they're going to go, I'm out there every day at practice, and when I see Jalen Petrie standing at the line of scrimmage across from Tank Dell or Stephon Diggs or Nico Collins, I'm like, no, please put an actual cornerback in there at that spot. But then there's other times when Jalen Petrie is blitzing or when they're off in zone especially, that it makes a lot of sense. And some of that, too, is you're going to be able to play the run a lot better, you know, theoretically, if, you know, he's got some tackling issues that he's got to clean up in terms of just form and consistency with his tackling. He's not afraid to throw his body in there, but he's just not he's got to improve his tackling. I think they're going to use him in a very versatile role, but it's probably going to evolve from week to week. And it's not like I'm not expecting him to all of a sudden be, you know, an all pro cornerback or something like that. He's not. He's a safety playing corner when he's in that nickelback position. And I don't feel super comfortable about it. But as long as you have a really good pass rush, as long as the pass rush projects out to what it should be, you don't have to play a lot of man. And D'Amico's never going to be a guy that plays a lot of man. They're going to play a lot of zone because they load up on defensive linemen to allow those defensive backs to play zone. So he's going to make some plays this year, Petrie will. And I think he can do some really good things. It's just there's no part of me that sits there and looks at him like, oh, yeah, he's totally now he's a cornerback. The position change of taking a guy from a less athletic position to a more athletic position in the NFL hardly ever works. It's very, very rare that ever happens. You don't see offensive linemen move into defensive line. You'll see defensive line move to offensive line, and sometimes it works out. And you'll see cornerbacks move to safety, and that'll work out. But it's very rare that you see a safety move to cornerback.
By the way, our baseball talk was presented by T-Mobile. Switch to T-Mobile, and you can get tons of benefits and save on every plan versus AT&T and Verizon. Use their savings calculator to find out how at T-Mobile.com/switch. On Petrie, do you think they know how best to use him at this point, or are they still trying to figure that out?
I think they're trying to figure it out. I think a lot of this, him running out there with the ones in the first couple weeks, I think has been as much about getting him up to speed on playing in a few different positions, playing more like his old Baylor role, and then for them to also figure out, okay, just how much can he do? So they put him out there, and, you know, I would say Kamari Lassiter, for instance, they did the same thing with him. I think they were very high on Kamari Lassiter, but I don't think they went into training camp thinking, oh, yep, 100%, he's going to be the starter. I think over the first couple weeks, he's looked good enough to be the starter. I think he's gotten better over the first couple weeks, that I feel like I can trust him, or I'll probably by the end of training camp feel like I can trust him to be a starting cornerback. With Petrie, I think they're figuring out what he can and can't do, and see how far he comes along with it.
I thought Azeez Al-Shaair was a little bit of an overpay. I no longer think that. Just talking to him, we had him on the show early in camp with Lopez. I was so impressed by him and just been really impressed by what he's brought so far. I think that might be, you know, they brought in Hunter, they brought in Diggs, they brought in Mixon. I think Al-Shaair might wind up being the best move that they made over the offseason.
You know, we've talked about this a lot, because when you start talking about culture, you kind of become deaf to it, because every coach talks about culture and so few coaches are actually good at instilling a culture or changing the culture. But with D'Amico, I feel like he 100% is not just giving lip service to culture. He thinks about it a lot, and he thinks about it on X's and O's level in terms of just like how accountable guys are, how much they understand and can play a certain scheme. And with Al-Shaair, that is 100% part of it. It's not just his play as a linebacker. It's the old school middle linebacker mentality of like, okay, this guy's running the show. This guy's getting everybody lined up properly. This guy's you know, dialed in on the mental side of things, and he's keeping other guys accountable. He's correcting their mistakes. He's getting them lined up. We've seen all of that with Alshire. And then as a player, there is very much that sideline to sideline dude. There is a blitzer. I think he's impressed me more than I thought I was going to be, because with Mike linebackers, sometimes, especially like Cushing used to do this early in his career. You would, or whether, you know, just when he was playing off ball as a Mike or a Will, like they start creeping up towards the line and they show their hand and before the snap, they just get too excited to blitz. Alshire is very patient, and Alshire he's duped the offensive line too many times than I'm comfortable with on just waiting, timing up the blitz perfectly, and then coming clean, just completely unnoticed by the offensive line, which is a whole nother issue that we got to worry about. But part of it is that Alshire is just really good at disguising all that stuff.
And I think D'Amico had him in San Francisco really from the second that he came in the league. So I guess we should have probably known that, you know, D'Amico knows this guy probably better than anyone. So if D'Amico wants him, then they should probably go out and get him. And there's probably a reason that he wanted him so badly.
Yeah, Nick had said that D'Amico is basically the guy who recruited him to sign as an undrafted free agent in his rookie year. D'Amico really liked him right from the get-go from his college tape. Nick talked about them when he was on with us the other day. The other thing, too, is I think when you start wondering, okay, who's the Sam linebacker going to be, it's Alshire is a good example of a guy that got his opportunities to play Sam linebacker as a young player with the 49ers, and that they don't play a Sam linebacker all that much. They're not in their base defense nearly as much as they are in their nickel defense. But that guy, it doesn't necessarily even have to be a guy who looks like the classic Sam linebacker or anything. I think for D'Amico, it's just who's your third best linebacker. We're going to get a guy out there that can play the run, but he needs to be good in coverage. And that's where there's a lot of competition right now. Like for who can be the next Alshire? Is it going to be Jake? They love Jake Hansen. He keeps coming back, you know, every single year. There's an athletic element to him where I think they really want to see if there's something there. But like Henry Toa, Delshawn Phillips, Neville Hewitt, those guys are all in a pretty tough competition right now for that third linebacker spot.
And Danielle Hunter, we talked to him early in camp, but we haven't really seen much of him, or we haven't like spoken to him media-wise since. It feels like he's really flown under the radar.
Yeah, I think that with Danielle Hunter, there's an element to his game where I always think of it kind of like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, it doesn't have to be, it's not something that flashes it, like the same way just a heavyweight boxer pummeling somebody does. It's a little bit, his game is kind of almost one of finesse and extreme technique. And a lot of the stuff that he's doing in practice, I know there's a viral clip of him beating Titus Howard in a pass rush the other day. But it's fun to watch because he's like the extreme technician. And there's things that he does that doesn't necessarily, it's not as impressive as, say, you know, Jadeveon Clowney, when he would make a play, it was like, okay, the guy covered like 0.3 seconds, like he covered like 10 yards in 0.3 seconds. But Clowney wasn't as bendy and as lithe as Danielle Hunter is. I think he's having a really good camp, but he's also approaching it very much like a veteran, where you can see that he's working on things. And there's times where, especially when he's going against Titus Howard, where you can see like, okay, yeah, in the game, that would have been a really good rep. But he's not, you know, he's not trying to tag CJ Stroud or anything. He's staying away from the quarterback. He's doing all the good things that he should. So I've been very happy with him so far.
And he's been around long enough to where he knows how to pace himself.
Yeah. And it's not like he's taking it easy or anything. It's just he's working on stuff. It's kind of like with veteran players, sometimes you look at it like a major league pitcher in spring training, where a major league pitcher can go out in spring training and give up four home runs but feel like he had a really good day because he was working on his slider. You know, but the batters all could see that he was working on his sliders, but he's just trying to get the location right. That's a little bit like Danielle Hunter right now in camp. I can see that he's working on some things.
All right, coming up next on Payne and Pendergast, we have an update on the Jeffrey Simmons versus a Nashville radio host saga. We have an apology. We'll play that next on Payne and Pendergast on Sports Radio 60. Adam Spillane in for Sean Pendergast. Seth Payne is here. Some breaking news out of the NFL. Tristan Wirfs, the offensive tackle from Tampa Bay, reportedly has agreed on a 5-year, $140.6 million extension. I believe 88, I believe, of that is guaranteed. So Laremy Tunsil, no longer the highest paid offensive lineman in the NFL.
Oh, I wonder if we're going to get a Laremy Tunsil side-eye emoji like he tends to do after some of these big contracts. We'll see. We've got Trent Williams is holding out with 3 years remaining on his contract in San Francisco at the age of like 53 or however old he is. I don't. Does Laremy Tunsil all of a sudden start withholding his services, which he is already withholding, but it's because he's rehabbing a knee and knee surgery. But still, does he withhold his services, or does this knee recovery end up taking longer?
I think he waits a year. Yeah. I think after this season, that's when he looks for the renegotiation.
I'll tell you what, that's one that the battle of public opinion will not be on his side in Houston, I don't think. Unless he makes a miraculous recovery in terms of false starts. The false starts are not as big a deal as it feels like, but man, people are not happy with the false starts because a lot of his false starts happen on critical drives. They happen in the fourth quarter. They're the most frustrating false starts ever. And if he doesn't pick it up in the run blocking, then he's not as good a complete overall offensive tackle as Trent Williams. He's got to be as good at run blocking as he is at pass blocking.
I get that, but don't let CJ Stroud get hit. That's your job.
First and foremost, that's the big deal.
That's the most important part of the job. Jeffrey Simmons, a couple days ago, went off on a radio host in Nashville. It's Buck. What's his last name?
Buck Riesing.
Yes, Buck Riesing went off on him. I guess Riesing had a tweet in practice that Simmons had a. He basically said that Simmons was being sloppy because he had started, I guess there were a couple of little scuffles during a Titans practice, which again happens at this part of camp. Simmons took exception to it. And so they were broadcasting at Titans camp. And so they're on the air and they're about to do an interview with another Titans player.
Roger McCrary. Yeah.
Yes. And so then Jeffrey Simmons comes over and he gives his opinion to good old Buck.
Well, Jeff, do you want to sit down? We can talk whenever you want to talk. Jeff, we'll deal with that later. Roger McCreary sitting down with us here on 104.5 The Zone. Jeff, I mean, we're on the air right now. I'm right here, Jeff. We can talk anytime you want to. Unbelievable.
We got
to
make that happen.
Well, we'll deal with that later on. Roger McCreary sitting down with us here on 104.5 The Zone.
Yeah. Called him up. A bad word that I found out yesterday you're allowed to put on the radio, but whatever.
That's right, by the way.
Yeah. No, Sean's almost never wrong about stuff. I mean, like, opinion-based all the time when he disagrees with me. But factually, he's pretty good on that stuff. So, it was interesting. It was interesting.
Jeffrey Simmons... So Jeffrey Simmons was probably wrong in that. I don't know if you thought that he was wrong with that whole thing.
I would say he probably. I don't know how much goes into it or behind it or how often the Buck Riesing has tweeted about him or something. But yeah, he probably should have handled it differently.
I will say this has to be tough for you because you are a player. You're a former player, former defensive tackle. So do you take the side of the defensive tackle or do you take the side of the radio host because you're both?
I take the side of the way Jeffrey Simmons probably felt because now I just would recommend he not handle it that way. I mean, that's the kind of thing you can go approach a writer at any time, and guys will do that. You'll go up to a writer and say, hey man, listen, I disagree with what you wrote. This is actually what happened or whatever. Because as a player, there's so many times where the observers are just wrong in their assessment of what happened. Like there's times where, and even, former players who are really bright guys, when they're watching the film and they don't know what the game plan is or whatever it might be, they're wrong a good amount of the time about whose fault a given play was. Because a lot of times a guy that looks like he's wrong was actually just trying to make up for somebody else's mistake. A cornerback, a safety screws up a coverage and a cornerback's running to try to correct it. And so he gets the blame. And it's frustrating. It's really, really frustrating because you're seeing in headlines, okay, either this guy started this or this guy screwed that up. But it's not anything that you can't rectify just by going and talking to the person when they're not on a hot mic, or when you're not maybe like threatening to actually fight them or something, or trying to intimidate them.
I think that's probably one of the biggest changes in all sports right now, especially in the NFL, because everybody has access to the All 22. And so anybody can take a play on it from the All 22 and break it down and think that they know what they're talking about. But most people have no idea what they're talking about, not because they don't know what's happening on the play, but like you said, they don't know what the responsibility was of the player on this play.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. Was when C.J. Stroud threw that interception in the Patriots preseason game last year, I watched Kurt Warner break it down, and like Kurt obviously knows what the hell he's talking about, and he wasn't hypercritical of C.J., he was just a rookie quarterback, but Kurt's reading of it was that the safety had been showing cover two, and CJ didn't realize it and threw a pass when he shouldn't have, when in fact that safety was showing cover two. I don't want to get too technical about it. Basically, he was able to disguise the coverage really well, and he was actually in man coverage on the linebacker, and that's why CJ got duped. And it was still the quarterback getting duped, but it was for different reasons than Kurt thought. And Kurt basically, like any quarterback, just sometimes doesn't realize that the defensive players are smarter than they want to assume we are. So yeah, like, and it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like he was crushing CJ or anything, but it's frustrating. It's really frustrating as a player. A lot of times, like with defensive linemen, especially, you know, they'll get blamed for not stopping the run, and you know that, and this is where sometimes you can't even go have the conversation with a writer, because they're blaming the defensive line for not stopping the run when really two of your linebackers played atrociously. But you can't go up to the writer, or at least you shouldn't. You shouldn't go up to the writer and say, hey, by the way, it was my teammates. I'm selling them out in defending myself. So and this is why tuning out the noise and staying the hell off of social media first and foremost is what more players need to do. Like, that stuff's going to be said responsibly, irresponsibly, wrong, right. They're going to heap praise on you when they shouldn't be heaping praise on you. They're just going to be wrong a lot. And you can't try to fight those battles, because it just doesn't. It's hard to fight those battles without selling out your teammates. So the best thing is to just, as much as possible, remain ignorant to all of it, and know that the people that are the decision makers on the team actually know what's going on.
So Jeffrey Simmons did apologize to Reesing personally, and then he did so again after practice publicly.
We all know what happened yesterday. A lot of y'all have been here since I've been here, so y'all know me. That's not who I am. That's not who I want to be seen as. I talked to Buck. We have an understanding. I have an understanding where I was coming from. I have an understanding where he coming from. He have a job. I have a job. At the end of the day, I take full accountability of my actions on the field. I mean, that'll never happen again with me. Like I said, I always talk about that switch, when to turn it on, when to turn it off. I was kind of still had it on coming off the field, of course, with the way practice went. But that, like I said, that's not me. It'll never happen again. And to all you guys, like I said, I apologize. And not because it's hit social media, but it's because who I am. That's not my character. And I think from here on out, like I said, from that point, like I said, I spoke on about it. I'm ready to move forward.
That's the perfect way to handle it. He did a real. That was a good. Public apologies usually, you know, they're usually botched somewhere along the way. He took full responsibility. He explained the situation, which is that it's the hardest thing, especially during training camp when it's so freaking hot, and you're coming off of when there's a scuffle or there's agitation or something. There's no cooling off period. The press is right there, and they're doing interviews with you, and it's the last thing you want to do. And obviously, he wasn't being interviewed in that moment, but you're still in football mode, and you're hot, and you just want to get inside. Like, stuff like that happens. So that was a genuine apology, though. He said, hey, regardless of whether it was captured on camera or not, there's just the wrong way to act.
And after a game, you get 10, 15, 20. You don't even have to talk after a game. You know,
yeah.
You can go hide in the locker room if you want. Here's my question. Did you ever get into any sort of an altercation or a shouting match with a reporter when you played?
Yes.
With who?
I flipped out on a Chronicle reporter once. Basically, where she was trying to, I didn't flip out on her, but she She was trying to ask me like a very nice question. I had made a speech after a loss in a season in which we'd end up going 2-14, but it was like, you know, six games into the losing streak. I'd given a speech to the team afterwards that apparently like a lot of the, some of the players really liked. So somebody talked about it to one of the media members and they asked me about it the next day. And I was, it was one of those things where it was like, it was presented in such a way that I could just see the story being written that it was like one of these made for TV moments or something. And I was just, I just come out of watching film where we were just even worse. You know, usually they say it's never as bad as it seemed on film and it's never as good as it seemed when you watch the film. It was even way worse than it seemed at the time from that game. So I was just pissed and I was, I basically just told her, I was like, no, I'm not talking about this. No, listen, no, you're making too much out of it, all that stuff. And then I went back and apologized to her like 3 minutes later. I felt really, really bad about it. And then there was another one when Bo Corona, who, you know, Bo Corona, who works for our company now and has for a long time, he had come into the locker room and, you know, he's a music DJ. And he was coming to the locker room to do kind of like a goofy DJ, ask you 20 zany questions.
Oh, no.
And I just, I think it might have been in that 2-14 season. I actually like legitimately kind of flipped out on him. He tells this story every time I see him. But he also includes in the story that I came back like 5 minutes later and gave him a, like, I genuinely felt awful about it. But it was, it's like, yeah, when you actually really care about your job, it's hard sometimes to talk to people outside about why your team is sucking right now or anything else around it. And like your emotions are raw. If I had had social media at the time, I would have had to be zero dark 30 all the time on it. I wouldn't have been able to handle it. I would have flipped out way too often.
I do find it funny that somebody was trying to write a positive story about you. You're like, no, I'm not talking about this.
Yeah, no, it's both times I've ever flipped out on reporters, it's been in positive moments where they're trying to give me a compliment or something. You're not approaching this with the gravity you should. Damn it. Do you understand the situation we're in?
So write bad stuff about you, and then that's when you'll give them the good stuff, is when they just want to rip you.
I'm ready for the bad stuff. If you're, you know, like if you're a good teammate, I always try to remember that. If you're being a good teammate, you owe it to your teammates not to care about what they're writing about you individually. You know, like, actually, one of the things that used to agitate me was when they would do stories out, because I was a nose tackle, that I was like the most underrated player on the team or unheralded or whatever. I'd be like, listen, you guys write enough of these stories that frankly, I'm becoming overrated at this point. So like, yeah, just stop writing about how I'm underrated, because I feel like I'm starting to get a little bit of like, well, he's not that underrated. So just lay off on the underrated stuff. I'm perfectly rated. Just let me fly under the radar.
All right, coming up next, Texans preseason opener tonight in Canton against the Bears. Who does this game matter the most for? We'll talk about that next on Payne and Pendergast on Sports Radio 610.